Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. He joins us every Monday in the 12 o'clock hour. We talk about the international economy, national economy, local economy, all of the issues that are impacting our lives generally each and every day. And with that, Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Great to be with you.
So, Guy, we had the Open Market Committee meeting, I think it was, what, last week, and we passed again on a Fed rate cut. First time in a long time that a couple of the governors voted, they did not vote in unanimity. They had a couple of detractors, and so where does this leave us?
Well, it's an interesting spot. It gets more complex because one of the Fed governors is resigning, so the president will be able to appoint somebody else more quickly than expected. And, of course, Chairman Powell's term ends in April of next year. So you have an argument for continuing to hold rates stable and an argument for reducing rates. So the argument for reducing rates is it seems that inflation has dropped. But in the last month, the argument for keeping them the same, inflation has ticked up. Core has gone up a little bit. CPI has gone up a little bit. And the economists at the Fed believe with absolute certainty that tariffs are inflationary. They just feel that they haven't had enough time to work their way through the marketplace. So their fear is that inflation will come back. Now, inflation hasn't come back yet, but there's a genuine fear and a little bit of a tick up. So that's an argument on both sides. Consumers still spending. So that's an argument for keeping rates where they are. On the other hand, consumer delinquency is going up, which is an indication of stress for the consumer. Fed is always worried about asset bubbles. And anytime you have super low rates, people tend to get into odd things. And we talked a little bit about crypto treasury companies last week. And these are companies where people are literally paying more to buy company stock than the underlying crypto assets that the companies own. So you're literally buying, you know, dollars and paying $2 and $3 to buy $1. And the Fed looks at that and says, this is an asset bubble. This is the sort of thing that will get worse if rates go down. So they're nervous about that. On the side of reducing rates, you had a tremendous adjustment to the employment numbers. And Fed has a dual mandate to keep low inflation and stable employment. So the employment numbers would argue for reducing rates. And the labor market is getting tough. It's intriguing. You know, there are always different corners of the market and anecdotes, but one that I thought was particularly compelling is the market for PhD economists has suddenly gotten weak. Last year and the years before, 100% of PhD economists had jobs within 30 days of graduating. Now, a significant percent do not have jobs, and that market had been super stable, super dependable, and the feeling is maybe that's the tip of an iceberg of educated people not being able to get work. And so you have arguments on both sides, argument for reducing rates, arguments for keeping them the same. And as you say, two dissenting votes, the president will probably appoint somebody that will also want to reduce rates. I would be surprised if he doesn't have that discussion with his nominee. So that would be probably three at least reduce rates in the next meeting, if not more. So doesn't clarify things, but certainly more pressure to reduce.
So the real battle then, underlying battle that's going on here is that the tariff policy needs to reach some maturity level, both in the decision-making by the president, because we have delayed implementation of certain, and I think we just recently delayed again. So that creates the uncertainty. There's a tail is what the Fed is saying, and they want to see what the impact of that tail is going to be moving forward. Unless and until we get there, they're going to be reluctant. The president, on the other hand, feels like, you know, their concerns are not warranted. I guess we do know from past history that both could be right, maybe, maybe not, I guess. I'm not so sure.
Well, we do know this for sure. Companies need to know what the rules of the road are. And passing the big, beautiful bill, setting the tax rates was one big step in certainty. So that was very positive. Locking down the tariffs, wherever they may be, is going to be the next step. And it's critically important for investment because you don't want to invest in something if you think that your competitors are facing a 25% tariff and then you get midway into building a very expensive plant and the tariff gets reduced to 10 or zero. So certainty on tariffs is very, very important. And if I were advising the president, I would suggest that he ask Congress to actually vote on whatever the new tariff scheme is so that people realize they're not going to bounce back and forth whatever, you know, whatever the new administration is, because for sure the president is term limited, so you will have a new president in 3 years. And it's tough to build a big manufacturing plant when you don't know for sure what the rules are. But yeah, putting in some certainty matters. The other thing is there are a lot of details that haven't been discussed. You know, the EU tariff at 15% with no retaliation is really a great thing for the U.S., except all 27 members of the EU have to vote to make that effective. So we think we have an agreement. You know, President Lagarde and President Trump both said that was the agreement they want. But if any member of the EU votes no, we don't have an agreement. And that's another part of uncertainty that's lying behind and underneath the challenge for U.S. manufacturers.
Well, Guy, we almost certainly know that France is not going to vote in favor of this, right? I mean, probably not.
I mean, they've been pretty vocal that they really don't like it. They're not in favor of it. Now, will they get pressured by the other members? Who knows? But yeah, if they vote no, Hungary's often been an outlier voting against the rest of the EU. You know, setting up the EU with an absolute unanimous vote, I think, was probably a mistake because you can't get 27 people to all vote all the same way. I mean, if I got all the members of our family together for a family reunion, we wouldn't all agree to vote on anything. You know, you have to have some consensus and compromise, but getting every single person to vote the same way is really a challenge. So that puts the EU tariff in question as well.
And then we are faced with trade restrictions that we don't end up talking a lot about. I think you probably saw the article in the Wall Street Journal this morning relative to China limiting the flow of critical minerals to defense manufacturers here, you know, magnets and the like, that's necessary for so many different things that we do in the defense industry, but in other industries as well.
Yeah, China is definitely looking at what leverage they have to resist the U.S. You know, China's made it very, very plain. They want to have a different world order. They want to have another group of countries, Iran, Russia, China, perhaps India, if they can get them on board, to counterbalance the U.S. And their thought is it's China's turn. And President Xi has said as much. He said, you know, for years, we've hidden our strength and bided our time, but it's now time for China to stand up. And so they're using the leverage of the critical rare earth minerals to extract better trade terms. Now, we've hurt ourselves in a lot of different ways in this area. You know, we have access to rare earth minerals in Greenland, in Alaska, in Nevada, but we haven't granted permits to actually mine them. So we can solve this rare earth problem. China doesn't really have a permanent monopoly on them, but we have to make an active decision at the U.S. and look, this is important. We are going to grant permits. You can do mining. We are going to encourage exploration, even in you know, states like Alaska that are primarily federal land. We are going to allow exploration in federal land, and also deep sea mining for some of these rare earth minerals. all of which would alleviate this crisis. But in the short run, China does have a strong negotiating position, and they're using it to try and leverage against the president on the tariff bills.
So let's get back to the ultimate question of reduction of the rate. The president wants, what, 2.5, 250, 300 basis points, 3%?
I mean, yes.
That's not achievable. I mean, and he wants that in one lump sum?
Well, that's economically unfeasible. Those rates occurred during the COVID shutdowns when the whole global economy was shut. And that's not occurring right now. You have, strong production. Despite the numbers, you're still gaining U.S. employment. So there's no way in the world the Fed is going to lower rates, particularly at that level. I can't imagine that they would lower rates more than 50 basis points, and I would actually be surprised if it's not just a 25 basis point decrease. One of the reasons they'd be very reluctant to do that is if there's a future problem, they don't have any runway left. We've discovered during the financial crisis and during the COVID era, if you bring rates below zero, it doesn't really work. The financial economy doesn't work with negative interest rates. Countries have tried it. Japan tried it for a while. Switzerland tried it. And it's really a counterproductive strategy. So if you lower rates that much, you've got almost no room if there's some problem, some economic thing crops up. Some of these odd bubbles, like the crypto bubble crash, you'd be very challenged to inject liquidity. So the Fed would not want to do that, and I wouldn't advise them to do that either. It would really be a sign of much more weakness in the economy than we're seeing. And I think that's a bit of the messaging that the administration needs to be cautious about. Super low rates are indicative of a crisis in the economy and some financial problem.
I like to divide these things up into comforting lies and unpleasant truths. And I think a lot of what the president is saying right now is really a comforting lie, because I believe the unpleasant truth here is that, and I would love to know your thought on it, do we ever in the near term, especially during his administration, get down to an interest rate level that we enjoyed during the pandemic? I don't think so, right?
No, that's an interesting phrase, because you say enjoyed during the pandemic. Well, the rates were super low, and some people really did enjoy it. Home buyers loved it. Home sellers loved it. Savers hated it. People on fixed incomes hated it. But it was a symptom of a very weak economy, not just in the U.S., but globally. And there's some other big factors, and the Fed looks over their shoulder at the bigger factors. There's a demographic challenge globally. The population in the entire world is aging, so you have fewer workers, which means more people that are on the receiving end of public benefits, and that's a challenge. You also don't have a big push in productivity. Rates were able to go down for years when China came into the market as the super low-cost producer. Well, with tariffs on China, with Chinese workers making more, you don't have that super push to low prices. So there's some demographic challenges that are going to make this difficult. The other thing is federal deficits, not just for the U.S., but for a lot of countries around the world, are a real challenge. And when you create more and more government debt, you've created an awful lot of supply. And at some point, demand doesn't keep up. And the adjustment is a higher interest rate. So demographics and government debt are both pushing you toward higher interest rates, not lower interest rates. So it's tough to see how we would ever get back to those super low rates we had during COVID. And I don't think any of us want another global pandemic.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that frustrates me, obviously, the pro-Trump administration economists that are out there, we hear this talking about a 300 basis point reduction, trying to get down to the same rate as during the pandemic. And they're not, really saying anything about it. I mean, it's just really not achievable. The more I read, the more I recognize that ain't going to happen. And it's certainly going to happen in the next 3 years, unless something disastrous in the economy happens. Another pandemic.
Well, and I think probably the way to interpret that is when you hear a Saints fan talking about the next season, what we all want as Saints fans is New Orleans to repeat the Miami Dolphins' perfect season and win the Super Bowl. That's our objective. Now, I don't, you know, Bobby Hebert is going to come on later and say we've lost our minds to even be thinking that way, but that's what we want. So what you want and what's real are two entirely different things. And yeah. I think people are expressing what they want as opposed to what's real.
Yeah. So true. So true. Thank you for bringing me back down to earth. I appreciate it. All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. It seems that the U.S. auto industry continues to have problems. Guy, tell us about it.
Really does. And the auto industry is a perfect example of an industry that should tell the federal government, please leave us alone. Don't help us. Don't protect us. Don't do anything for us. Just get away and let us run our business. It's hard to believe now, but there at once upon a time, GM was the largest and most profitable company in the world. You know, today it's the tech companies, the Microsofts, you know, the Amazons, but once upon a time, it was GM, and a number of different things conspired to sink the auto industry, to push their employment from, you know, GM over 650,000 direct employees to now just 77,000. But OPEC oil crisis, bad management decisions, bad labor, and government intervention. So we'll start with OPEC because the OPEC oil embargo in 1973 caused the U.S. government to create the corporate average fuel economy standards of 1975. And at that point, GM, because they were the leader, had a corporate average fuel economy of 12 miles per gallon. Cars weren't particularly efficient. Gasoline was cheap. Big V8s. The standard was set at 27.5. So literally, GM and all the other makers were going to be pushed to reach a 27.5 mile per gallon standard. Of course, the government said this will be great. It'll save the consumer money. But what they didn't realize is it was going to push the automakers in ways that they just weren't set up to handle. The automakers, back in the day, Henry Ford set up Ford, and it was a great company. But Ford was completely vertically integrated from mining all the way up to manufacturing and sales, concentrated in Detroit and in Dearborn. When the automakers started running into labor trouble, they decided they would decentralize manufacturing. So they moved out of Dearborn. They had a lot of different plants in different places. They wanted multiple suppliers. And instead of negotiating better deals with labor, they said, We're just going to have a lot of different options. We're not going to be concentrated in one place where they can have a strike and shut us down. So bad labor relations, bad management decision, you lose this concentration of workers. And then the government says you've got to do something, basically turn on a dime. Well, if everybody had been in one place, all the different component manufacturers, the engineers, you know, they could sit around a table, they could meet at lunch, they could meet on weekends and work things out. With manufacturing scattered around different places around the globe, you couldn't get everybody together. So the car makers had to, in a very inefficient way, try and double fuel economy in a very short time. And they created some very odd cars. You may remember the Oldsmobile diesel. It was basically a gasoline engine dieselized. Total disaster. You know, people bought them, but the gasoline engine just wasn't built in a sturdy enough way. So you had a lot of warranty claims, a lot of dissatisfied customers. You had other cars that were rushed to market to maintain and to meet these fuel economy standards. And because they were rushed to market, the quality wasn't very good. And so Americans became disenchanted, and it created a big opening for the Japanese car makers that were already making small cars because they have small roads, relatively compact geography. And so they had the product that people wanted to buy. And it, we talked about it before. The American sedan market just went away. There's an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal. It's a guy named Dan Neal that writes the car column called Rumble Seat. And he's talking about hatchbacks. And he said, you know, a quarter century ago, there were lots of hatchbacks in the U.S. market. The market was crowded with fast, fun, functional hatchbacks. Today, the only hatchbacks are the Golf, which is a VW, Honda Civic, Type R, Honda, Toyota GR, Corolla, and an EV Hyundai. So no U.S. hatchbacks, very few U.S. sedans, and the markets, the car makers push to get back into the fuel economy standard, really pushed them to make cars that people didn't want to buy. They wanted efficient cars, but they didn't want cars that were difficult to maintain, cars with manufacturing defects. So the manufacturers were pushed to do something that they couldn't do in a short time frame. They put themselves in a bad position by delocating the different parts manufacturers, so they didn't have the brain power to work on it together. And the government continued to ratchet up the fuel economy standards. The last standards were actually in the 50s. And it was appropriately called an EV mandate because if you think about it, there's not a gas-powered car that can actually make 50, nor can the average of the fleet make a 50-mile-per-gallon mark in fuel economy. So people were forced, the manufacturers, GM once again forced, along with everyone else, to push into EVs. And it was a pushed conversion that happened too fast, just like the last conversion to a better fuel economy. And the result is unpopular cars. And U.S. market share for EVs climbed to almost 10. It's now fallen to 9 and is falling on a fairly steady basis. So twice, U.S. makers were pushed to do things that they weren't ready to do. They invested lots and lots of money, and they ended up with cars consumers didn't want to buy. So a combination of bad management decisions, bad labor relations, and the government trying to help them really sank the car business. And the headline number is Ford Motor Company lost money this quarter. And Ford is the company that makes most cars in the U.S., and the tariffs that were supposed to help Ford didn't help because aluminum was taxed at a high rate, as was steel. And Ford's best-selling vehicle is the F-150, which is mostly aluminum. So it's a long way of saying the U.S. auto industry has really been hurt by a lot of different things, including bad management, bad labor, and certainly more government interference that's really put them behind the eight ball.
It sounds eerily similar to what actually is going on right now in the airline industry. Right. I mean, we've lost a number of manufacturers. Boeing facing another walkout with their machine shop here in the Mideast. And then Airbus, who has made up a lot of the differentials in the availability of new planes, they're facing these significant tariffs with the EU. Again, in the Wall Street Journal, they were comparing what's actually going on. This whole airline industry seems to be a mess now.
It is, and if you think back, once upon a time, you had three big manufacturers. You had McDonnell Douglas, makers of the famous MD-80 line of airplanes. You had Lockheed with the iconic L-1011, and you had Boeing. And we ended up with basically one U.S. manufacturer, and then the Europeans got together and created a competitor in Europe. So you have no competition, a lot of pressure to turn out planes that are meeting the different standards of the EU and the U.S. But with only two manufacturers, you don't have diversity. And on the defense side, you know, Boeing is the only manufacturer of the F-15. So as those workers go on strike, it really is going to hurt the ability of the U.S. to produce planes that other countries want to buy. I mean, one of the things that the president did negotiate that made sense was that the Europeans would spend more on defense and would buy most of those munitions from the U.S. Well, if they want to buy F-15s, they can't make them while the F-15 assembly lines are on strike.
But, Guy, this is what I don't get. And, you know, so we've not protected ourselves from our supply chain for most of what we produce in the defense-related field. And we rely on China. And, you know, it's like they've never not been our enemy in the last 20 or 2 to 3 decades. So what I don't understand is what were we thinking and what were we doing?
We're doing what was easy. And, you know, there was a time, and I think we all bit into it, and I sort of thought it was happening. Okay, once the former Soviet Union broke up, we don't need to spend a lot of money on defense. You know, the era of big country conflict is over. China was very deliberately playing a low-key role, and they said it in their party congress, we're going to bide our time and hide our strength. And we were lulled into this peace dividend and thinking, okay, life is good. We can, you know, we can just source things from anywhere, wherever they're cheap. It doesn't matter if we're getting things from China for the U.S. defense industry. And then things turned around in ways that no one could have anticipated, or I guess people studying history would have said, of course we could have anticipated it. You know, Russia launched a land war in Europe, which no one, I won't say no one, very few historians expected to occur, thought the era of land wars in Europe was over. And suddenly, countries started looking around saying, we need to, up defense, and we need to have stable supply lines that are supportable in case of a conflict. And, I mean, heaven help us if we have an actual conflict with China. They're certainly not going to ship us war materials in the middle of a conflict, and we hope that never occurs. But it really is something that the defense establishment needs to focus on and to work with the genuine allies, the EU, Australia, et cetera. How can we build a free world supply line that is robust and will work in the face of some potential conflicts?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, almost as each day goes by, this becomes increasingly complex in ways that at least the general public and the media hasn't been talking about, right? I'm sure economists were piecing all of this together at some level, but we certainly weren't aware of it all. And when you begin to read, the more you read, the more you recognize that we've negotiated ourselves over the last 3 decades into a corner internationally. And I don't know that there's any easy way for us to get out of this. You know, and because as we change administrations, moving back and forth, Republican, Democrat, the perspectives are entirely almost polar opposites of one another. And we take 3 steps forward, 2 steps back, or the other way, depending on one's viewpoint.
Yeah, I think it makes us refocus, and I would definitely refocus on both domestic capabilities, because the U.S. is a big country with lots of resources. We can make essentially anything we want. And if you extend to our allies in the EU, Australia, New Zealand, and then I would definitely make peace with Canada, whatever way we need to do that. That's another big ally, another source of raw materials. If you have this hemisphere plus our allies, we have the ability to have a secure supply chains. And that's something that really should be a strategic focus. You know, the just-in-time manufacturing where things were coming from around the world was tempting, but it makes you very vulnerable, particularly when your big supplier is China, which is adversarial to U.S. interest.
No doubt. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We're going to get to a break. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, we talked about a number of fraudulent schemes over the past several weeks. It seems as though there are more.
Yeah, there always are. And one of the ones that's hitting right now is the FedEx scam. And you get an email. It looks exactly like FedEx. It says, "We're sorry, your package appears to be delayed. We regret to inform there's been an issue with the delivery of your recent FedEx shipment. We understand how frustrating this can be. We're actively investigating to ensure we provide you with the best solution possible. As an apology, we'd like to offer you a compensation product up to $100 in value. Click here." As you and I have talked a million times, don't click. Your FedEx package may be delayed, but FedEx is not sending you $100. They have never done that. You know, we've shipped lots of FedEx packages. They've never wanted to send us $100, and they don't want to send it right now. This is totally fake, but people are falling for it. The fraudsters make it look very authentic. It's the colors, it's the logo, and who wouldn't want $100? And of course, when you click, they need your info, all your information in order to send you the money, which you're not going to receive. And now your identity has just been stolen. So new fraud, same deal. Don't click it.
And there's others as well, right?
Yep. A version of the theme. There was a breach of the major credit bureaus. And we've talked about breaches, and we've warned people to freeze their credit. And most have listened, some have not, but the credit bureaus were breached. And so essentially all of your sensitive data, including your spending and your Social Security, were captured. And what this one says is it's from Equifax, ostensibly, but it's not. You haven't claimed your settlement from the breach. We have a gift card for you, because this is your part of the settlement. Click here. Once again, give us the info, all your personal info, as well as your bank account number, so that we can send you your part of the settlement. And unfortunately, people are clicking on it because it has enough reality to be tempting. Yes, there was a breach. Yes, Equifax was guilty. They had lax security, but they don't send gift cards. And they're not looking for your personal information. As a result of the breach, they provided free credit monitoring. They encouraged people to freeze their credit, but they did not send out gift cards. And anytime you see a big company saying, "Oh, we're going to send you a gift card," that should be a red flag. But this is one that we've had people click on, and they come to us, unfortunately, too late and say, "Well, I gave them all this info." It's like, "Oh, please. Okay, we'll help you freeze your credit. We'll help you avoid being defrauded further." But yeah, FedEx and Equifax gift card fraud are definitely hitting the wires this week.
Seems as though these fraudsters are getting more and more innovative in their approach as to the companies that they're allegedly representing and sending out these emails.
They are, and they're very clever because they make it look exactly like the company. They're able to copy the logo, the colors, and I'm looking at the FedEx one right now. I mean, it's really cute. It's got the purple FedEx background with the white Fed, orange X, and then under this, "We're really sorry," there's a nice little picture of a package. It's like, oh, that's pretty neat, pretty well done. Whoever the graphic artist was should be commended, except it's all crooked.
Yeah, it's getting a little bit crazy out there for sure. Let's finish up something that's not been talked about much, Guy, with just about a minute that we have left, the Cambodia-Thailand conflict. There was a ceasefire. Has that changed?
Has not, but the interesting thing is what was underlying it. Those two countries have been sort of having a tit-for-tat for years, mostly about temples on the border. But what really pushed this one into armed conflict is Cambodia runs casinos and also a big scam network called the Pig Butchering Network. Thailand is looking at a law in Thailand to legalize casino gambling in Thailand, which would present legitimate competition to Cambodia's illegal operations. And the Cambodians were really distressed because they're getting paid significant bribes by the Chinese operators of these casinos and scam operations. And so it literally boiled over into a shooting war, mostly originated by Cambodia. And this was a case where the president used his tariff threat against both of them and said, no, y'all cut this out. You resolve this some other way, or we're going to really super hit you with very high tariffs. But the underlying cause was Cambodia not wanting to have competition for their illegal casino and scam operation.
That's an interesting cause of that conflict for sure. I mean, this is getting crazier by the day in many respects.
Yeah, once upon a time we had the soccer wars in South America. These are the casino wars in Southeast Asia.
In Southeast Asia, no doubt. Guy Williams, as always, thank you so much for your time, your insight. Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Have a great week.
Oh, you too. It's good to talk to you.
Folks, we'll be right back. Check in with Scoot to see what he has coming your way. Stay with us. Scoot's up next, and he joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, we'll talk about the art of vacation and what it means to each of us. You know, do you just go see something, or is part of vacation really about just escaping the reality of life and just getting away from, you know, in our jobs, it's getting away from politics and things like that. But we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about the death of Lonnie Anderson. Also, we have a list of the top 10 best sitcom ensembles, the best cast for sitcoms. We've got a list of the top 10 that I totally disagree with. So we'll talk about that. And Stevie Nicks had to cancel part of her tour because she re-injured a shoulder. She's being called the undisputed queen of rock and roll. Is she? All of that and more coming up.
Stay tuned, folks. Scoot headed your way with a great lineup. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Monday evening.